would like to express my appreciation to Aaron and to the rest of you for this invitation. It's good to be here. I commented to Aaron when I walked in this morning that I think I've been in this church building a number of times for meetings and the like. I've driven by. We live just a little ways west of here. But I'm not sure that I've ever been in your sanctuary. This is a beautiful space. It has a really good feel. It also has something I'm not sure if you're aware of. You can see so many things. A pulpit with a clock. I don't know if Aaron brought this. Usually when pulpits have clocks, they're put there by parishioners. And I don't know if there's a reason for that. But one thing you need to know is that Aaron's done a dangerous thing here, and maybe that's why the clock is here. He's invited a preacher who is currently without a pulpit to spend time with you, and quite frankly, I could go on all day. And I am quite aware that there is a ball game going on at the same time. I will be careful with this invitation and do my best to stay on track. I would like to read for you a few words of Scripture. We have in the Bible a wonderful gathering of traditions and stories and an account of the experience of all kinds of people. Sometimes stories about individuals, sometimes about communities, quite often about the interactions of people with one another, with what they find holy and divine, and quite frankly, with what they find human. The Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, tell us something about Jesus and the people who wandered through life with him. There's a lot of similarity in a few of these Gospels. The first three, they have some of the same stories, and you can see some parallels. John was the last written, and it's a bit different than the others. It's not written so much as biography as it is theology. I want to read for you, and I want you to think about what it is that this writer might have been trying to communicate to his community. And what is it that this writer might communicate to our community, to people like you and me? I read from the fourth chapter of the Gospel of John. Jesus, by the way, here is in a bit of trouble. This is not unusual for Jesus. He's in trouble with the religious people. That's not unusual for Jesus either. Now, when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard Jesus is making and baptizing more disciples than John, he left Judea and started back to Galilee. But he had to go through Samaria. We need to stop right there. It's always a tricky thing to comment on sacred text, but I'm going to do it anyway, since I'm a guest and can leave. He had to go through Samaria, but really, he didn't. This is the first thing that would have gotten the attention of the original hearers of this word. Samaria was an odd little land between the kingdoms of Israel. Judea in the south, where Jesus currently was, and Galilee in the north. At one time, if you read through the Hebrew Bible, through our Old Testament, you'll find that it was all one country. But over the years, some interesting things had happened, and now there were two kingdoms, the northern kingdom of Galilee and the southern kingdom of Judea. In a land where a certain kind of ethnic, racial, and religious purity had wound its way into the consciousness and traditions of the people in that middle area had somehow gotten mixed up a bit. Because of folks coming from the outside, some of the purity had begun to change. Samaritans were Jewish people who were not ethnically, racially, spiritually pure. They worshiped the same God. They had many of the same practices. They had a common heritage with other Jewish people. But they were just a bit different. We think of Samaritans as good. If you get online, as I did, to look up Samaritans on the internet, and you Google the word Samaritan, you'll find 3.5 million hits on the World Wide Web having to do with good Samaritans. Samaritans may or may not have been good as individuals. When Jesus talked about relating to Samaritans, he was asking people to deal with their xenophobia, their fear of the other. Their relative goodness or badness was incidental. They had to go through Samaria. Most of the religious people of Jesus' day didn't have to do that. In fact, they would lose a little bit of what it had come to mean to be religious if they did. They would either follow a circuitous route to the east over the Jordan River and up into the mountains that took 3 days longer, or they would follow the coast of the Mediterranean, which took nearly 4 days longer. Anything in your life, anything at all like that? I know the parts of me that will go to all kinds of trouble to go around that which makes me uncomfortable. I know the routes that have become commonplace for people like me and for me. They had to go through Samaria. But they really didn't. Jesus was doing a very new thing here. He had to go through Samaria, so he came to a Samaritan city called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired out by his journey, was sitting by the well. It was about noon. I don't know about you, but if I look at that which I find different long enough, I tend to see something of myself. This was Jacob's well. This was in the midst of the history of the people of Israel. Now, lest we become even remotely anti-Semitic here and think this is Jesus talking about a certain arrogance among Jewish folk, let us keep in mind that Jesus was Jewish, and that I think he's talking here about what exists in the hearts and minds and spirits of a lot of us, regardless of our affiliations. He stopped at Jacob's well. Religion goes out of its way to look at the world in static fashion, as though it really doesn't change. And yet here we can find out how much changed. The people might have thought nothing has changed. We are Jewish, they are Samaritans. But really, the world had been changing not around them, but within them all along. Jacob's well. Right there, Jesus found himself at the intersection of his people's history. This was the center of his heritage. And yet, because he lived in a world like ours, people thought he was out of place. A Samaritan woman came to draw water. And Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." his disciples had gone into town. They were probably a bit uncomfortable with this whole thing. When they came back, we won't read all of this because it's a whole chapter, and it's the longest interaction between Jesus and others in all of the New Testament. So the fact that there's a ball game, we won't read the whole thing. Read later this afternoon, you'll find that the disciples, the good religious folk, not the same religious folk that wanted Jesus out of Judea, but even his friends, even those who moved with him, were uncomfortable with what he was doing. When they came back, they found him talking with this woman of Samaria. This was an illegal interaction for a number of reasons. Because of race, because of gender, and because of religion. But he was doing it anyway. What makes you uncomfortable? This is not a sermon on sin, so I'm not going to tell you what makes me uncomfortable. But here is a hint. I wonder if you see it in your life like I see it in mine. I reserve a special kind of angst for people who are a lot like me, but different in ways that perturb me. These Samaritans were not unlike the Jewish folks who make up the community of the New Testament at this point in time. There wasn't that much difference, but there were some perceived differences that made it so hard. I can sometimes get far more comfortable with someone who lives way different than me, someone of a different tradition. My real prejudices and biases kick in when I'm dealing with someone who's enough like me, but different in ways I find important, that I'm perturbed. I spent Friday night with a close friend, a Muslim man who has been a family friend for years and years and years. While he was sitting probably looking for my faults and foibles and quirks, I was looking at some of his. He has a certain patriarchy, a certain chauvinism that kind of makes me uncomfortable. Maybe it's because it makes me think of my own such things. But I usually end the evening kind of blowing it off and in my biased kind of way saying, he comes from another culture, a fairly patriarchal culture. So I can understand that. However, if I was with a Christian person who exhibited some of the same language and ideas, I'd call him a right winger and see how terrible much difference there is between him and me, even though we share most of what we have in common. When you look around your life, in your neighborhood, in your church, in your family, Do you see difference? And does it make you uncomfortable? Driving out here this morning, we live near Colfax in Quebec. I saw new things every time I come this direction along a main street. I see new things, new signs, new stores. We live in a city that is in the midst of tremendous transformation. I suspect most of us would know how to drive around that. Most of us find that in our lives that will make us comfortable in the midst of a dynamic, changing reality. Jesus, I think, would have us move right through it, right in the midst of it, rather than around it. How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria? Jews do not share things in common with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have no bucket." Therein lies much of the trouble of Christendom. We live in a world that is far more complex than our thinking. We live in a world that is broken despite our fondness for wholeness. And we live in a world in which the one we turn to, the one we see as holy, the one in whom we find inspiration, we live in a world in which that one has no bucket. I suspect that the day Jesus needs a bucket is pretty much every day. The irony is not simply that these two people came together, but that the one who was viewed as less than, the one who had been marginalized, if we read on, we'll find that she had been married 5 times. She had been pushed to the outside again and again and again. It was her who had what Jesus needed. So, if we ever get our courage up and go through the center, there will be irony. Because most of us will assume that when we go through the difficult places and perhaps put aside all our phobias, most of us will probably go there thinking that they're going to need us, when all along they have something we need. Because Jesus, the Jesus that we follow, has no bucket. Isn't it interesting who had the bucket? I grew up in rural South Dakota, and I spent my summers on my Uncle Andy's farm. Uncle Andy's farm was a hog farm, so it had a special kind of fragrance to it. I sometimes associate stories with that kind of aroma and fragrance. There was an artesian well on Uncle Andy's farm that was at the center of my family's heritage, still is. My cousin still farms this land, just like his father, our grandfather, our great-grandfather, and our great-great-grandfather. This artesian well is central to what our family has been about in that place, not unlike Jacob's well. A barn has been built around the artesian well, and very intricate wooden troughs that carry the water through the hog pen down a little stream and into the pond. As a child, I remember my mother, during one of the stories about walking uphill in the snow to school both ways, she talked about how hard it was to be on that farm cutting ice out of the pond for the ice house for the summer. I remember my grandmother talking about swimming in the pond. Over and over and over again, we heard about how central this little well and its water was to our family's heritage. Before the water could get to the pond, it ran through these hog pens and through these old makeshift troughs. And the hogs, they would push their way up to that trough and get exactly what they needed. At least the big ones, and the little ones that they protected. But I wasn't very old when I noticed there were some hogs that didn't get into the trough. They weren't at the center of that little hog society. And my Uncle Andy would take an old 5-gallon plastic pail, dip it in the trough, and he would spend the better part of an hour making sure there was water out around the pen for all the hogs. I don't know who has the buckets in this community, and I don't know that you can make anyone drink, but wouldn't it be interesting to make sure that the water is there for those who want to? If this church is like any other church, if you folks are anything like me, it's tough to think about this kind of Christianity. We do a good job in church with our rituals and our symbols. We get things set up in a way that's comfortable for us. And quite frankly, it takes some doing. So much work that there were only a few who would follow Jesus on his meandering path. And quite frankly, the religious people ended up having their way with him anyway. It's not an easy journey to move through the midst of that which makes us uncomfortable. But it may be that we are closest to what is truly sacred in this world when we give it our best. There's another little interesting piece of the Gospel of John. I'll leave you with this. A little later on, Jesus has been tussling again with the religious folks. That story about who throws the first stone after the woman is caught in adultery? You know the story. If you read on, the religious folks follow Jesus and continue to press him. And they begin to call him names. They answered him, says the 48th verse of the 8th chapter, "Are we not right in saying that you are a Samaritan and have a demon?" Jesus answered, "I do not have a demon." In the eyes of the writer of the Gospel of John, either Jesus was a Samaritan, a person of mixed heritage, or for Jesus, it didn't matter. He denied having the demon. That's a good thing. But he left the charge of being a Samaritan stand. When we move through the midst of what makes us uncomfortable, we may experience that which is truly sacred. Amen.